Investors Chronicle.
Welcome to the Companies and Markets show. It's Thursday, the 18th of April, as we record. A week in which Chancellor Jeremy Hunt said the UK economy had achieved a soft landing, begging the question of whether it's truly a soft landing if the plane doesn't take off in the first place. But there's no denying the outlook looks a little brighter for the UK and global economy at the same time as things are looking a little more complicated for stock markets. Intertwined with both those things is the uptick in prices for a variety of different commodities this year. So we'll be discussing what's changed for industrial metals like copper with our commodities correspondent, Alex Hamer, in just a moment. Then our cover story this week is on the UK's most popular active fund, Fundsmith Equity. Our fund's editor, Dave Baxter, is here to run the rule over its recent slightly more mixed performance and ask whether it's still a best buy for investors. And we are also looking at fast fashion retailer ASOS's full year figures and ask whether it's on the road to recovery or something more problematic. Senior companies writer Jennifer Johnson is on hand to discuss that one. And our associate editor Alex Newman and companies editor Mark Robinson are here to give their input as well. So on with the show. Welcome, everyone. Commodities. Quick quiz question for everyone. What's the best performing commodity this year? Anyone know? Any ideas? Any thoughts?
Gold.
Gold, says someone, says Dave. Alex.
Uranium.
Uranium. Alex Hamer, you're looking at some kind of sheet, you're trying to cheat. What have you got there?
Embarrassingly, I have no idea.
Well, I think it might be a cocoa, which you've written about.
Ooh.
Chocolate prices going up a lot. We're not talking about that.
When I wrote about it, it was only at $4,000. Now it's at 10, so... You know, readers got in early on that one.
Yeah, well, there you go. Holding those Easter eggs. But we're talking about metals today, which have also been going up in price quite a lot. Gold, as Dave mentioned, is one that has attracted a lot of headlines. But the industrial metals also, Alex, have seen a bit of a surge this year. Can you talk about what's behind the price rises for things like copper? What's been going on in the last few weeks, months to drive these price rises?
Things like, you know, copper, demand is still fairly weak in China. The industrial situation there is not a reason for copper to climb so significantly, but that's all on the supply side. So there's worries in Chile mostly about supply, and that's been carrying on since last year, where these very old mines are often having supply issues, whether it's due to grade or even local protests. The newer mines, which we've seen in the mine that Anglo American's just built, you know, supply is down there as well. So there's supply concerns with copper. But I think speculators or financial buyers particularly are piling into metals. And you see it across the bands. I mean, oil's up, which drives commodity indices higher, which drives more buying. And so that's kind of pushed them up. And then with other metals, aluminium's an interesting one. That's climbed, I think it was 8% or 10% earlier in this week because the US and UK brought in new sanctions on Russia. And that feels a bit weird saying as we get into the third year of this war in Ukraine, but they've only just now limited buying of certain Russian metals on the exchanges in the UK and US. And so that hits aluminium, nickel, platinum group metals, and they've climbed. And obviously Glencore is superbly positioned and is making a lot of money anyway.
Mm. Is the general improving economic outlook helping as well? There's been some suggestion of more demand from China, and general soft landing, to go back to that phrase from the start, must also be helping a little bit as well.
Yeah, I think, I talk about the supply side with copper. Like, you know, with China, it's not that demand is decreasing in a weaker environment. It's just that demand is not climbing as much as the trajectory that someone sketched out 3 or 4 years ago might have indicated. So the industrial picture is certainly strong enough to drive continued buying.
With copper in particular, there's been this story for years now that the world needs more of it. That is what's going to drive the price higher, this supply shortage relative to demand, whether it be demand for the green energy transition, or latterly for all kinds of AI-based data center, artificial intelligence, what have you. Is that coming to pass now as well? This supply squeeze is what people have been talking about over the past few years. Am I, on the other hand, just putting a long-term narrative to what is a short-term price move at the moment?
Yeah, to answer your initial question, is that squeeze happening? No, but it all plays into it. When you have these players coming in and pushing the price up through, you know, speculative purchasing, you know, they are buying into that longer term narrative. I mean, there's no real issues with getting enough supply right now, but if you buy into it and, you know, at about $8,000-$9,000 a ton, and using that demand scenario that you've mentioned, you think it's going to go to $13,000-$14,000 a ton, and there's others, you know, Lyrum, for example, London Investment Bank, their long-term price for copper is $6,200 a ton, so far below where we are now. So there's you know, skeptics of that story as well. But if you have that view of energy transition driving, you know, demand for copper wiring as electrification spreads further, you're going to want to get in at these levels, especially when supply in South America is uncertain and new projects from the US, Australia, parts of Africa are having a tougher time getting up as well, you know, and you see a move in the short term. You know, one, you know, I think like you've said, there is a risk of conflating, you know, short-term movements driven by speculators with longer-term demand-supply imbalances. But, you know, it does all play into, you know, the narrative right now.
And that supply story isn't the same across all metals. Iron ore, for example, suggestions that is very much the opposite. There is still more supply than demand.
This week, we had operations reports from Rio Tinto and BHP, two of the world's three top iron ore producers, with Vale in there as well. And there were, you know, slight reductions on the last quarter, but, you know, they've both said they'll meet guidance. I mean, for BHP, you know, we're 9 months into their financial year, so it's not a shock that they're going to hit guidance. Rio's just done its first quarter because they have a calendar year, financial year. They've stuck with guidance as well. So they will, yeah, I think supply is pretty consistent from those two for sure.
That probably brings us on to FTSE companies in general, FTSE miners, and we've discussed those too. And Glencore, Anglo has had a better time of it share price wise, as you'd expect in recent weeks, given what we've been talking about. Can you distill the differences for someone coming to the sector completely afresh, what they should be looking for in, relative to these prices and who has what exposure, that kind of thing?
Yeah, well, I think the best performer recently has been Antofagasta, unsurprisingly, because it's 100% copper, well, with a bit of gold as well, which obviously helps right now. So Rio and BHP are dominated by iron ore, but I think as part of that, we've talked about those that general improving sentiment on the sector. Even though iron ore has not performed as well as the other metals, their share prices have done fairly well recently. And I think Glencore has a broader range of earnings drivers, but, you know, that was dominated by coal 18 months ago. Now it's a bit more spread. But I think, you know, I mentioned before, Glencore is kind of also a trader at heart, to the point where Reuters reported this week that they were certainly making hay off the shift in policy on Russian metals through dancing around the specific requirements of the sanctions. So I think Glencore is always going to be a company that will, you know, whatever the situation, do fairly well with earnings. They're in a bit of a transition at the moment. So they've agreed to buy the coal assets of Teck Resources, a Canadian company. So they've lowered their dividend payments in order to cut their net debt before a company split into a base metals and trading operation and a coal company. So Glencore is, you know, it's in a bit of a funny place right now, but is also offering the same as it's ever offered, with, you know, slightly fewer dividends.
We should probably conclude this segment on gold, because that's been attracting a lot of attention. The price has been going up and up fairly vertically recently, and yet at the same time as the dollar's been strengthening and bond yields have been strengthening, which are sometimes seen as inversely correlated. Well, quite often are seen as inversely correlated. So if there's some confusion over various commodity price rises, it seems there's always confusion over why the gold price is moving as it is. Do we have any answers on that front at the moment?
Well, I think we, you know, if you go back a few months, there were real expectations of rate cuts, you know, I think up to 6 for the year. And I think you had gold climbing on the back of that, but it had already risen a fair bit, you know, not to the $2,000 an ounce level, but over 1900, even with rates still quite high. So you had that, you know, the traditional narrative wasn't working that well then. But then that narrative did kick in once the rate cuts were expected. And now they've obviously been pushed back and gold's climbing again. And, you know, I talked about the head scratching before over some of the metals prices movement. It's the same thing with gold. I mean, what's been a big driver over the past 2 years is central bank buying. We have central banks, China, Turkey, Russia, buying up a lot of gold. They've eased off significantly this year, probably because it's so expensive, but the prices has kept running. And I think, you know, one analyst floated buying volumes in China, not from the central bank, but by consumers as a real driver. They've had to put trading limits in Shanghai on some of those products. But at the same time, in the US and Europe, coin buying is quite weak. And ETFs, gold ETFs have seen outflows as people make money off this with gold at 2300. So it is a really interesting moment for gold. And I think the other part to probably add in is that people have moved to gold in at times of geopolitical risk, and that's definitely driven it up as well. But you know, where it goes from here, I'm not sure.
As is always the case. thank you, Alex. We're going to turn to our cover story now. Fundsmith Equity, as we said at the top, the highest profile fund in the UK in many ways, certainly the highest profile active fund, run by Terry Smith. Dave, can you give a bit of a context, though, for the piece? Because it's still got an incredibly good long-term record, but the past few years, relative performance-wise, have been a bit tougher. Can you talk a bit about that in some detail and what you were looking at with this feature?
Yeah, so as you mentioned, or as you allude to, you know, you had a decade where it was just a supreme safe pair of hands and seemed to always outperform the MSCI World Index, regardless of what was going on. That has changed a bit. And in the last 3 calendar years, we've seen the fund underperform that index. You know, sometimes that has been, as last year, the fund performing well and having a rebound, but having less of a rebound than the global index, which, you know, in part is explained by the distorted nature of markets, the Magnificent Seven racing heads and all that kind of stuff. But it is kind of raising questions, and we're seeing more money come out of the fund as investors are, you know, asking whether it looks as good as it once did.
And in the piece, we've looked at a variety of metrics over most of the life of the fund and had a look at how those have changed as well, because there have been some changes in the nature of the fund, whether it be sector exposure or regional exposure, and of course size as well. Can you talk a bit about some of those?
Yeah, so we looked from the end of 2012 onwards, and there have been some big shifts in the fund that might surprise investors. Looking at, for example, regional exposure, the fund has always been pretty heavy on the US, and that's ticked up a bit over the period. But what's really interesting is if you look back at, say, back end of 2012, it was much more focused on the UK than it is now. Had, I think, you know, around a quarter or so of the fund in UK shares. And now it's drifted more into kind of European names, ticked up, as I mentioned, in its kind of North America weighting. And it's interesting that the team said they're not really interested in where something's listed, but then they went on to say, actually, what we've been doing is we've been kind of favouring European and US rivals rather than UK names. So perhaps that is a bit of a kind of indictment on the state of UK markets.
Yeah, there's some examples they give, don't they, such as Procter & Gamble rather than Reckitt and things like that. They do still hold Unilever on that side of things, but also Novo Nordisk in Europe ahead of GSK or Astra, things like that. So these individual decisions are all adding up to change the regional allocation a little bit. That US exposure, as you say, has always been relatively high, but the exposure to big tech has increased over the years as well, which has to, well, to an extent, I always think there is an element of career risk here when those stocks are doing so well. you know, it's very hard to have zero weight in them, no matter what your process. There's no doubt that these kind of shares are the kind of quality shares that Terry Smith would buy, so it's not a case of style drift. Nonetheless, exposures there have been rising quite a bit in recent years.
Yeah, they've really ticked up. So, you know, Microsoft has always, or at least for a very long time, been a big feature of the fund. Often it's kind of top holding. But what we've seen from around end of 2018 is names like kind of Meta jump in. We're now seeing a little bit of kind of Alphabet, Apple. The fund, of course, had a kind of brief fling with Amazon. They held it for 18 months, 2 years, and then decided to sell out. But yeah, just the overall weighting has really ticked up. And as you said, maybe it's kind of acknowledgement of both quality, but also the fact that these stocks are becoming so hard to ignore and you don't want to get kind of passed by on that front.
The sale of Amazon, sell discipline was one reason Morningstar, in a recent note, downgraded the fund. Can we say a little bit about that? And also, let's discuss Terry Smith's response to that that he provided to us, because that's quite interesting too.
Yeah, it's really interesting. So Morningstar was saying that with kind of buy and hold managers, you tend to see a bit of a slipping in the kind of selling discipline when they get outflows and they have to kind of manage that. And they have made the argument that there's now a kind of lack of rigor when it comes to the selling discipline. So there's PayPal. Terry Smith says he sold it too late. But on the other hand, there's talk of kind of getting out too early with names like Amazon and Adobe. As you mentioned, Terry Smith's response is really interesting. So they basically agree with this criticism. And they made the interesting point that sort of getting things wrong with names like PayPal actually caused them to, I suppose, the pendulum to swing the other way. And then they ended up kind of selling, they tried to overcorrect and kind of sell things a bit quicker, but that meant that they kind of missed out on better performance from names like Amazon. And when they're trying to reflect on the lessons, they say the lessons, of course, aren't obvious, but they do point out some things like, for example, if there's a big tailwind from some market theme like AI, for example, maybe you shouldn't be so hasty to sell because you can take some gains a little bit longer and then get out.
Yeah, they were quite frank about it, weren't they? And they say part of the problem they found was that these two groups were giving them different lessons. One lesson was to sell the first sign of trouble. The other was to, you know, hold on and try and see things through. So sometimes it can be difficult to work out which lesson applies to which company. But it was interesting that they were acknowledging that difficulty in there. I'm going to bring in a moment Alex Newman. But before we do, Dave, thoughts on the future of the fund? Again, as with gold, as with anything, it's very hard to have a crystal ball. Nonetheless, we can provide some insight there, perhaps, not least on the nature of the fund and how growthy maybe it is now versus how defensive it is and how it might be expected to do in different market conditions.
Yeah, there's a couple of points. I mean, one separate point, first of all, is maybe concerns are justified that the fund has to hold bigger companies than it once used to, which might limit growth to some extent. On the other front, you know, they have a growth bias, and you might argue that they have more of a growth bias given that they have those even more of an allocation to those big tech names. That means that when you do have a big growth sell-off, as we saw in 2022, the fund may be more exposed and you may have more volatility. Equally, it might ride these kind of waves even better when things are going well for those kind of stocks.
Yes, that tech element certainly provides that exposure to growth, as you say. At the same time, the traditional Terry Smith quality stock and buy quality, it's a shorthand for perhaps a slower and steadier long-term compounding kind of business, a consumer staple, a defensive healthcare company. Those should provide some more ballast. But what we've seen in recent years is it is relatively sensitive to the performance of growth stocks now too. So that should be kept in mind. Alex, as I say, I'm going to bring you in what your thoughts are on the Fundsmith Equity Fund and Terry Smith's strategy.
I suppose looking backwards, we can, you know, it's definitely to his credit and the fund's credit that we're holding him to, you know, this high standard. So it's not every UK equity fund manager that we compare to the MSCI world, which shows that, you know, with Terry Smith, it's always a proper conversation about high returns, the best returns you can realistically expect from the market. Just reading Dave's piece, it did make me think that maybe just the nature of the fund means that he's slightly hitting the buffers a bit here. And that's something that over the next few years, it looks like, you know, the size effects and just the pool in which they are fishing for their next big positions, it's just making the job all that harder. And that's kind of just a product of success sometimes in fund management, that, you know, when you're managing a 30 billion, you know, or 25 billion pound fund, it gets a lot harder to move the needle. Was also drawn to the comparison with Warren Buffett, which obviously, you know, we make every other week on this podcast in the magazine. But, you know, a lot of the qualities that that Terry Smith sees in a business are, you know, essentially echoes of the Berkshire Hathaway view of the world. If I was going to make a bet, I would think that Berkshire Hathaway's asset portfolio should outperform Fundsmith over time and from here for a couple of reasons. One is that when you're never inclined or compelled to time your set, you know, your sales and your purchases, that they're, you know, this is so much the conversation around Fundsmith is, did they get the timing perfect? That's so hard to do. But if you're not compelled to get your timing perfect, which Warren Buffett isn't because he likes to hold forever, then that, you know, that better marries the buy and hold instinct that has made Fundsmith such a success. And the other thing is, when you are fishing in, you know, in a quite rarefied, mixed metaphors there, when you're going after ever bigger fish, you can't miss, but also you are going after the biggest companies, which are theoretically the best understood and where price discovery is most limited. So your ability to outperform the market diminishes. I mean, yes, if we rewind the clock 10 or even 5 years, we can say that with hindsight, no one actually properly priced the Magnificent Seven correctly. But, you know, it still makes the challenge ever greater from here to you know, you really can't miss when you're at this scale.
The Buffett comparison is interesting, notwithstanding its regular use on this show, because Terry Smith did say recently, having famously said he would never buy bank shares, that he was considering buying a bank. And who knows, he may already have done so. There is a recent unannounced purchase the fund has made that they will announce once that position is built up to size. So maybe he's becoming fractionally more like Buffett in financials exposure. We'll have to wait and see on that one. That is our cover story this week, though, so do pick up a copy of the magazine. Look online for that if it's whetted your appetite. Result of the week time now. Jen, you have written about ASOS this week. The fast fashion retailer has been on a bit of a rocky ride the past couple of years, probably longer than that, to be honest. But what do the latest results show? What do they show about the health of the company and the problems it's been working through?
So on the face of it, I think you can reasonably say that things still don't look great for ASOS, though they have arguably improved somewhat. So their interim pre-tax loss was £270 million, which is better than the £290 million loss it posted in the first half of last year, though turnover was down 18%. On the plus side of things, at the end of the first half, it had £593 million worth of unsold merchandise kind of sitting in its warehouses, against a full year objective of £600 million worth. So that means that planned reductions are running ahead of schedule. Reducing this massive, massive inventory is kind of the thing that that ASOS really needs to do. It mostly managed to achieve these cuts via heavy discounting of this old stock, which resulted in its adjusted gross margin, that's kind of its preferred margin measure, falling 260 basis points. Though markets and investors have seemed to kind of welcome these results and welcome this progress, though it is incremental. So across this week, shares are up 7%. So I guess it's all in all kind of a very mixed set of results, but mixed on the kind of negative side of things. There's still a long way to go.
It's a good thing you mentioned their interim results, not full year results. I said at the top of the show, it's one of these annoying companies that doesn't correspond to the calendar year and makes me look bad. but yes, the results were relatively well received, weren't they? I think they were sticking to full year guidance as well, which, given the difficulties in the top line for half year, is probably taken positively by the market too. There's still lots of questions about the business, though, of course. Can we stick with inventory to begin with, though? Because that destocking process does take a long time to work through, and they've kind of changed their practices for the future as well. That what they're trying to say is that this is a year of transition as we work through all this stock, and as of fiscal 2025, things will be better. So what are they kind of doing to change the business model in that regard?
So in short, they're basically just trying to make it more agile so they don't end a certain season. So say they don't end winter with a stock of loads of coats that no one is going to want. So they call this new model, part of it's called test and react. So that involves bringing stock into the business on a 2 to 3 week lead time. That's sort of designed to reduce risk because shorter lead times mean lower initial purchase orders on the group's own brand products. For its the third-party brands that it sells on the platform, it's planning to adopt a stockless model, so it's not going to have warehouses full of these items in future. And another kind of key thing is management said it's going to remove old stock from its model by clearing products close to the season in which it's relevant. So that means you're selling off your remaining winter stock in perhaps a kind of January or New Year's sale. You're getting rid of spring stock in the summer. And this all has to do with ASOS's target audience, really. It's this younger, trend-led cohort. And fast fashion like this moves quickly, so you can't be left hanging on to things that are, you know, quite literally out of fashion so rapidly. So essentially, the ASOS's rescue plan for itself is to hold less stock, and the stock that it does find itself left with at the end of a season, it plans to shift more rapidly. But whether it can actually do this, I think there are sort of questions around that.
Mm. You would think in theory, wouldn't you, that for any retailer, quick inventory turn is quite important. You think it should be doing these kind of things from the start, but maybe the pandemic had something, and supply chain issues had something to do with the way that's changed. It was only a couple of years ago we were talking about resilient, long-term supply chains, long lead times, and now everyone's back to immediate, just-in-time inventory, which does make sense in this industry. Mark, I'll come to you in a moment because you've been patiently waiting all show, but I'm going to turn to Alex Newman again to begin with, because Alex, I think you think ASOS, they had a refinancing of debt last year. I think you think they may need to raise some more money soon.
Yes, I think, well, the positive is that there's, you know, there's obviously brand equity in ASOS, you know, you can't build that overnight. So, you know, they are shifting between £3 and £4 billion of product each year, which means they have a customer base and people like what they're selling. But as to whether the stock is investable, I think the answer at the moment is no. And that's because it is still heavily loss-making, as Jen mentioned. Analysts, I think, this year expect an operating loss of £72 million for the year to August. I think management said with these results that they still expect sales to decline from here. So they've got a really, really tricky job of just breaking even over the next couple of years. But at the same time, the clock is now ticking quite loudly because in 2 years' time, they've got to refinance a £500 million bond, which comes due in April 2026. So that's currently trading at something like 65p in the pound, which implies that there's going to be some sort of restructuring. And I would expect that would result in some kind of serious shareholder dilution. Because, you know, it was a genius move to issue a 500 million bond when they could get it at 0.75% interest. I think today they would struggle if they were to reissue a bond to get anything below 7%, which means they've just got a huge chunk of interest costs just to recatalyse their balance sheet. And yeah, just to underline the point, I don't think this seems like a business that can easily absorb a huge new cost base without a capital injection from elsewhere, and that probably has to be equity or some sort of sale.
Mm. Mark, what are your thoughts?
Well, I'd just like to expand on a couple of the points that Jen made earlier as well. I mean, this all sort of boils down to the question of inventories in the end. And why, while they're ahead of schedule at the moment, the 593 million of unsold merchandise, that equates to about 20% of annual revenues. And when you look at the standard sort of inventory to sales ratio across most sectors, it's usually pitched at between 10 and 20%. This is online retailers. But with fast fashion, there's a bit of leeway, or the theory is there should be a bit of leeway there because of the turnover. And so, you know, you could be pushing up towards 25%. Now, that would suggest that ASOS are actually within that range at the moment. But, you know, given the relationship between inventory levels and net profitability, you could see why they'd want to sort of perhaps rein that in a little bit over time. You know, you've got to remember as well that it was years before the company achieved what might be termed critical mass in terms of its sales. And it actually managed to retain a lot of the sales boost that it received in the post-pandemic era as well. But obviously, net margins, they've remained poor right through that period. And given that link to inventories, it's no wonder they're sort of trying to look at their supply chain arrangements at the moment. Dan, you made that good point that it seems to be somewhat at odds with the general push towards supply chain resilience. But I think it's part of the same argument in a sense. You know, I think it's a recognition that supply chains play an absolutely fundamental role for companies like ASOS. But one other point as well, you know, it could be that obviously fashion by its very nature, and I don't know quite why you've brought me in to comment on the fashion industry, to be honest, but...
me neither, you know, but you insisted, Mark.
But there was always this sort of focus on seasonality in there. I'm not quite sure that applies to quite the same degree for a fast fashion retailer, but Jen probably has a much better insight on that than I do. But, you know, it's going to come down to them being able to get those inventory arrangements efficient enough where they haven't just got stuff sitting around in their warehouses and that sort of locked in capital. You look at the rating for the company at the moment, it doesn't look particularly good when set against other online retailers that have struggled as well, like Boohoo or even the Hut Group. So things are far from positive at the moment. I was unaware as well that they had to refinance their debt too, which is... the company does, you know, generate a lot of cash, but the overall sort of prospects remain sort of questionable at the moment.
I suppose there's a question to go back to Alex's point of how or if companies can dig themselves out of these kind of holes, you know, once they're in that situation when they've got so much refinancing due in just a couple of years, how easy it is to actually turn things around, no matter how many efficiency gains you make. If ultimately the top line is under pressure and you've got that debt burden, then things are going to be quite difficult.
I don't know. I guess you could contrast it in a way to the experience of Amazon, which started a long time ago in terms of e-commerce. And it took a long while for that group to achieve critical mass too. But the difference is that it's a broader based proposition, and you know, perhaps they've both gone down the same route. I mean, at Amazon, arguably, I'm waiting to probably hear from the lawyers about this, you know, when they were primarily selling media products, books at the beginning, they were cutting to the point where they weren't really interested in profitability so much as, you know, building market share and eliminating the competition. In the case of ASOS, I mean, it's pretty difficult to do that because there aren't particularly high barriers to entry when you're selling fast fashion, you know, specifically fast fashion items. So there, you know, there's many more sort of operators in that corner of the market than there were, say, 10 years ago even. So that might explain as well why you get this continued pressure on the net margin, and management have been looking at cost savings and see if there could be more of a focus on that in the future. But that seems to be inevitable given that pressure and the increased competition, and it sort of almost comes to a, a race to the bottom at the end of it as well. Mm. It's a sector I've never really felt comfortable with because I just don't understand it that well. But you know, when you look at the sort of, it seems to be inbuilt. You're going to have an inbuilt problem because of that inventory issue. So
indeed,
there we have it.
Thank you. My heartbeat was racing when you were saying the lawyers would have to get involved. I thought you were going to slander Jeff Bezos or something. But
No.
I think you were fair enough in saying that Amazon certainly prioritized volume to begin with. But yes, on that interesting comparison, we have sadly come to the end of today's show. So thank you very much to everyone for taking part. Thank you to Mark, to both Alexes, to Jen, to Dave, and to our producer, Maddie Apthorpe. We will be back next week with another Companies and Markets show.
When you make decisions for your company, you look for the no-brainers. And if you have a lot of mailing to do, Stamps.com is the ultimate no-brainer. It streamlines your processes to make your business more efficient, which makes you less busy. Mail checks, invoices, legal documents, and everything you need to keep your business running with Stamps.com. Seamlessly connect with every major marketplace and shopping cart. Schedule package pickups and see your cheapest and fastest shipping options from different carriers. With rates up to 89% off USPS and UPS rates. And with the Stamps.com mobile app, you can take care of mailing and shipping wherever you are. Make the same no-brainer decision as over 1 million other businesses with Stamps.com. Sign up with code PROGRAM for a 4-week trial, plus free postage and a free digital scale. No long-term commitments or contracts. That's Stamps.com. Code PROGRAM.